Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you haven't ordered your copy of Peter Hart's new book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, now is the time to do it. The Gallipoli Evacuation was one of the most important chapters of the entire Gallipoli story, and this is the first book to explore it in detail. From dithering politicians in London, to the winter storms, to the ingenious ruse that enabled the Allies to escape, such as the self-firing rifles and the silent periods, this book tells the whole gripping story of this life and death gamble. And Peter Hart really is the man to tell this story with his wonderful writing style, his insightful accounts of the history, and most importantly, his use of quotes from veterans of the campaign. The story of the Gallipoli evacuation is really told in the words of the men who were there. The book is now available in softcover or ebook, and you can order it all over the world and pay in your local currency. So visit our website, livinghistorytv.com, to order your copy today.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History. Today, something I'm really looking forward to. Our special guest is Richard Van Emden, who has written more than 20 books about the Great War. He probably knows more about it than just about anyone, but in particular, he has a great fondness, and over the years, he's spoken to a lot of veterans and collected a lot of stories, both in terms of speaking to veterans and also collecting their photos and documents, etc. So I thought it was a great opportunity to get him on the program to talk all about his experience of speaking to veterans and telling their stories. So, Richard, thank you very much for joining us on Living History.
My pleasure, Matt.
For those of us who don't know your work as intimately as we probably should, why don't you tell us a little bit about just the work you've done over the years? I mean, how did you first get into this passionate obsession with the First World War?
Well, I've wondered that myself, actually, because it goes back such a long way. I'm not entirely sure. I think I probably saw a program on TV about the Great War and realised I knew absolutely nothing about it. My next memory is my mother sort of saying, "What do you want for Christmas?" And I said, this was in Christmas about 1984. And I said, "Oh, I don't know. Just get me a book on the Great War. You know, so I know nothing about it." And she got me Goodbye to All That by Robert Graves. And the moment I read that book, I was hooked. I absolutely knew this was my passion. And I immediately sort of gemmed up on medal ribbons of Great War veterans, went straight down to the Chelsea Pensioners home in London, in Chelsea, and started wandering around looking for men with the medal ribbons of the Great War. And I started interviewing them. And that in itself became the passion for me. I wanted to speak to the men who were there.
I can't tell you how jealous I am of that, Richard, because I have this feeling that I was born 20 years too late. And in the whole time I've been obsessed with the First World War, I only ever got to speak to one Great War veteran, and that was a rare privilege in itself. But how many veterans do you think you spoke to over the years?
I interviewed just over 270, on the old-fashioned kind of tape record, cassette recorders. Most of them appear on that machine. I started interviewing them from 1985 onwards. I did set myself a target. When I started interviewing, I said, I want to meet 250 Great War veterans. So because I managed to get into TV and because I started working on documentaries, that target probably would have been inaccessible, but for the fact that I started working on documentaries about the Great War. And so I was able to tour the United Kingdom. I came to Australia on a couple of occasions to interview British veterans just outside Sydney, actually, in Harbord, a great, great Scottish veteran out there. So I managed to travel a little bit of the world and of course, right across the UK. Whenever I found a veteran, I was invariably in a car and off to see them.
Whenever I've spoken to veterans, obviously mostly given my age, that they've been Second World War veterans, but I found that as they get older, especially as they get into that sort of in their 90s, they seem to open up a lot more than they may have done earlier in life, because perhaps they feel that they've got to tell these stories before they're gone, or they might be the last member of their unit left. How did you find it speaking to these veterans in the 1980s? Were they forthcoming? Were they happy to speak to you about it? Or was it a bit of a challenge to get them to open up?
No, exactly as you found it, Matt. I was very fortunate. I had veterans who said to me, quite honestly, if you'd come to see me 20 years ago, as in, you know, say I'd met them in 1995, say 1975, they said I wouldn't have spoken about it. But so many of them were aware of the fact they were going to take these stories to the grave. Some of them didn't want to talk to their families about it because of the emotional turmoil, and they weren't always sure exactly what they were going to say. And so having a stranger come into their house, it was like people being honest on a train, you know, people just sort of open up or someone think they're never going to see again. It's the same sort of principle. They chatted to me. I mean, I had veterans who doctored what they said, so they wouldn't entirely open up. You could see that there were avenues they didn't really want to go down. But I only ever had one real blank refusal out of 270 plus. So exactly as you found it, Matt, they wanted to talk at the end.
Did you find, Richard, that your discussions with them enhanced your understanding of the war, or did it simply confirm things that you already suspected about what went on?
Oh, God, it enhanced it enormously. I mean, to be honest, I'm embarrassed by some of my early cassette tapes because, of course, I was almost using these people as a kind of petri dish, you know, trying to sort of get an idea of the Great War itself. So sometimes I went with utter ignorance of certain stories and, you know, I was reading all that I could. But when you're 19, 20, you're just starting to get interested in the Great War. It was the veterans themselves who gave me the parameters of the story. And so, you know, I'm aware of some of my early cassettes where the veteran says something really significant and I just don't get it. It just washes over me. I don't see the historical significance. I'm thinking of one particular veteran, in fact, whose brother he was called Genoa, and his brother was murdered in Brandenburg POW camp. And this actually was an incredibly famous story in the Great War there's a government white paper about it. It caused a huge storm at the time. And this was this guy's brother. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's your brother, but I want to hear your story of the Somme, you know, tell me about your... And so I kind of said, oh, let's move on, you know, let's talk about the Somme, your experiences. And I missed what was an extraordinary story in itself. I just couldn't see it. And so... you know, the veterans gave me so, so much. And it wasn't just the kind of, you know, we're always aware of the fact that, a soldier in a trench only sees 200 yards either side of him. So for me, it wasn't so much about the battles and about the fighting. It was the little inconsequential details that I used to love, the little stories that you wouldn't pick up unless you spoke to a veteran. It wasn't recorded in the history books. And so those are the sort of stories that I love more, if anything, than you know, a soldier's perspective on the Somme, when in fact, in reality, he could only see so much.
Well, a lot of your books that you've written focus on the experience of individuals. Where do you see that the importance of oral history comes into our collective memory of the Great War?
Well, I mean, it's critically important to listen to these guys. And that's not to say they don't have false memories. you know, I had a couple of veterans who one was purported to be a Great War nurse, another exaggerated his military career to the extent, unfortunately for him, his service record survived, and I could see that what he was telling me wasn't correct. So, and also I was talking to veterans right towards the end of their lives. I mean, I've got interviews with veterans who are 105, 106 years old, and of course you get problems with memory, but it's, as I say, for me, it's the small stories that really matter, the things that would have gone to the grave and which we simply wouldn't be aware of. And there are 1,001 details like that I have on cassette, which just paint a picture of the war, a very different picture of the war to those that you read in history books. And that's what the veterans give you. I'm not asking them for, their views, particularly on Douglas Haig. I'm not asking for their synopsis of the Battle of the Somme. I want those tiny, tiny details that will go with them to the grave unless they tell me. And I've got so many of those. And that just paints, as I say, an entirely new picture of the Great War.
Someone that we both know quite well, Peter Hart, who we've had on the program before talking about his illustrious career interviewing veterans as part of the Imperial War Museum. He says the same thing that you've just said there, that what it adds to the historic record, because they tell you things that they wouldn't have put in a letter home or that they wouldn't even have written down in a diary. It only comes out when you press them for the details that sometimes they think are inconsequential. Did you find the same thing? Did you find that asking them questions about the small facets of their life painted a much bigger picture of your understanding of the Great War?
It did. And it also, Peter and I slightly disagreed, actually. He may be unaware of the disagreement, but he was quite down on some of the veterans right at the end of their lives. But I think he was looking at them in terms of broader historical accuracy. Could they give that to me? And I think he felt that they possibly couldn't at the end. I agree with him, but what I was after were those stories. And I'm thinking about one chap called Cecil Withers, who was 105, I think, when I interviewed him. And he'd never really spoken about his war. So in a sense, he was really, really interesting because what he said was fresh. You know, occasionally with veterans, you knew they'd told their story 1,000 times over and it came across like that. With him, it wasn't. And it was, there were little moments when you still saw what the war meant to people like that. And there was one where he said that it was at Arras in 1917 and the Germans had done a counterattack and been badly cut up. And he said, I was standing in a trench and I could hear crying and screaming out in no man's land. And I could hear this German soldier going, mother, 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 or mutter, 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 out in no man's land. And this corporal walked past and he just said, I don't know why he's crying for her. He'll never see her again, you know. And he just said, those painful words really, really cut me to the core. And to see him say that and to see what it meant to him, you know, this is 90 years after the events, that he felt that comradeship with a dying German in no man's land, and this you know, hardened Lance Corporal made this comment, and it just painted that picture of what it was like to be in the midst of suffering, really intense suffering I can never ever appreciate, which tells me something about these men's lives and about what they went through. And again, I didn't need him to tell me the story of the Battle of Arras or even his battalion's particular, service there. But what I wanted was those sort of details. And that told me so much about how these veterans suppressed the anxieties and the emotions and the pain of what they saw for so, so long. So every single story you got, it didn't really matter who it came from. You know, occasionally you've got details. I mean, I remember interviewing one veteran who was out, again, it was 107 or something. And he didn't really, there wasn't really a lot there. And he spoke about, he was in the artillery and he spoke about a horse that had got trapped in the mud. And he was whipping this horse, trying to get it to rise. And it was just the kind of, he didn't want to hurt it. He desperately needed this horse to get up out of the mud. The horse was exhausted. And this was one story of very, very few that he still had. But you could see the anxiety. You could see the misery of the occasion. And to me, that was a really astonishing story, given that there was so little else that he could tell me about. But this story had lodged with him all his life, and it was so vivid the way he told it.
The last time I spoke to you, Richard, we were doing the book launch for Peter Hart's Gallipoli book, and you mentioned in a discussion with Peter, a rather freewheeling discussion with Peter, about you were talking about veterans, and you mentioned there was a veteran at one stage who, in telling you his story, he began to relive the experience, and for a moment, he was actually there. Can you recall that story? Tell us a little bit more about that.
I think his name was White. His surname was White. And he was in the King's Royal Rifle Corps. And, it was on the Somme. And he was a slightly strange individual. When I met him, he was very hung up on his treatment after the war. He felt he'd been really badly treated, as a lot of veterans did. And I appreciate that. But when we started talking about the war, he was blind. So he was kind of reliving the story. I mean, Peter had a friend like that, didn't he? A Gallipoli veteran who he said who was blind, and he could sort of relive the story behind his eyes. And this veteran did a very, very similar thing. And as he told me about one incident of going over the top and getting into the German trenches, he started to lose it. He started to be there. So he started shouting as if other men were with him, you know, get down, get, no, over there, behind you, get down. And suddenly, it was the only time it ever happened to me. I was in a room with a man who was back in the trenches, really, absolutely back in the trenches. And he was fighting. It was hand to hand. And he didn't lose it. I mean, he didn't sort of fly out the chair or anything, but he was there. He was absolutely there. And I remember being mesmerized by that. It's on a cassette somewhere. The only issue is I'm so scared to play these cassettes because I just think the cassette record's going to chew them up. So whether I'll ever listen to this story again, I don't know. But I remember thinking, I think this will probably be a unique moment for me in terms of being back, actually being on the Somme with a veteran, albeit 80 years after the events happened.
That's absolutely extraordinary. I have chills as you're telling that story because it is time travel, isn't it? That is the only opportunity those of us who were born so many decades after the war would ever have to even get a hint of what it was like. Even as you're just telling that story, it's something that I'm thinking about now. I'm thinking, yeah, if you were in a platoon and charged trenches, you would be shouting out to your mates. You would be shouting, look out over there. Let's move in this direction. It's just elements that we otherwise would not get by reading a dry old history book.
Yeah, and so many of these veterans locked these stories away. And I'm thinking of my sister, for a time, worked in a nursing home, and she called me after it happened, but she rang up and she said, oh, we've just lost a gentleman in the home today. He was in the late 90s or something. He'd been in there, he'd been in this home since the Great War, and he'd said nothing. He'd been almost mute and had very little interaction with anybody. And then my sister suddenly said, one day he just started screaming and shouting again, back in the trenches. They were all astonished by this, and as if he was there. And the next day he died. And she said, I realise now it was just a release. It was all been bottled up for all these years. And suddenly it all came out. And it can't have been a coincidence, she said, that he died the following day. I mean, you know, I wish you'd called me in a sense, because it was a historical moment in its own way. I mean, it sounds heartless, but, you know, it gives you a bridge into the Great War, which is so, so incredibly rare. And this man was just letting go. He was letting it all out before he then passed away. And I feel very much for him. And there are so many veterans I felt deeply, deeply for, because, and in fact, one of my books I dedicated to a veteran I never actually met, although I sat within 10 yards of him. And this was in a home just outside Newcastle. And I used to go and visit this veteran who'd been in the, again, another one from the Rifle Brigade. And he'd been at Hooge in the Flame Assault in 1915, the famous one. And I said to him, are there any other veterans in this home? And he said, well, yes, there's a man called Matthew. He's in a home just down this corridor there. And he said, but I don't advise you go and see him. He's blind. He's incontinent. He's just in a bed all the time. So I said, look, of course, I respect that. And then one day I visited James, this veteran, and I said, and he said, oh, Matthew died. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. And on the way out, I spoke to one of the nurses and I said, I hear Matthew died. And she said, yes, you know, he needed to go. And she said, and you know, the amazing thing was when James, who was himself crippled by arthritis, and he was in his mid-90s at the time, she said, we watched him without any, he wasn't aware that anyone was watching us, watching him. And he got up out of his chair and pushed his Zimmer frame down the corridor. And we went out, we weren't sure what he was doing. And he walked up to the Matthews door and he stood there and he stood erect and he saluted. And then he turned around and hobbled back into his chair again and didn't say anything more. And she said he was unaware that we were watching him. And she said it was so, so moving. So one of my books I dedicated to Matthew, and I said to Matthew, whoever he was, and I'll never know, we'll never know who that veteran was, but he died that lonely death in an old people's home in, what, probably about 1988, 89. And I still remember him, even though, as I say, he's one veteran that I never met.
It's extraordinary the work you do, Richard, because these links with these men, you know, who 75 years after these traumatic events in their life are still reliving it. It's still such an important part of them. Isn't that just the most fascinating thing about speaking to veterans, that this was for most of them, it was a small period of their life and they went on to do other and, you know, greater things with their life, but it always stayed with them in such a strong way. Did you always find that when you spoke to veterans, that this, even though this was so long ago, it was a very important part of their story?
It makes me laugh, actually, because occasionally you had veterans who would get grumpy about it. They'd say, I was only in France for 6 months. I was only in France for 6 months, and all they want to talk about is my Great War service. They're not interested in anything else I ever did. And then you would hear somebody say, "Oh, tell me about your life as a gardener or something like that." And invariably, the veteran himself would get back to the war. So sometimes they kind of were slightly annoyed they weren't being talked about it. But if they didn't talk about it, that's exactly what they went to. So even Harry Patch, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of him in Australia, but he was Britain's last Great War veteran, last one to serve in the trenches, and he died aged 111 in 2009. And he used to say that, you know, I was only in France 3 months, or in Belgium, actually, for 3 months, you know, but that's all they want to talk about. And so I said, well, let's write your story. So I wrote his biography, The Last Fighting Tommy, because he wanted to tell people about the rest of his life. But invariably, you know, even though we wrote about his Victorian childhood and his Edwardian upbringing and things like that, and it's absolutely fascinating, the Great War was what everyone went back to. And in the end, it was a nice story to write, because I knew him for 11 years, from the age of 100 to 111. And so for me, I was fascinated to see something other than the Great War, to talk to him to see how the Great War figured in his whole life. And actually it was something that had been a monkey on his back for the best part of 90 years. Or 80 years, he'd never spoken about it to anybody. And I just happened to be the first person to rock up and say, tell me about the Great War. And he, interestingly enough, that first interview, I drove all the way down to Wells, which from London is probably about a 3-hour drive. It's quite a long way. And he said, and very happy, he was willing to talk to me about the Great War. And he told me his entire story in 5 minutes. And he just said, well, I think that's it. I think that's everything I can tell you. And I could see that it was there. I could see there was so much more, but he didn't know how to get it out, because he knew he would get emotional about it. And that started what was turned out to be a great decade plus long friendship, because I was there at the start. I was able to tease that out of him. But equally, we built such a great friendship that I said, look, after a while, I said, we don't need to talk about the Great War anymore, Harry. We can look at the rest of your life and we can do this book together. And so that in a way was really, really special to have that bond of friendship. And in fact, my son, who's now 13, his third name is Harry, in Harry's honour. So you can see how much that meant to me.
That's absolutely wonderful. I mean, that's obviously a wonderful connection you had with Harry Patch. What are some of the other veterans? Who are some of the other veterans that you felt that connection with, that you remember most all these years later?
Well, on Armistice Day, or any other occasion where we remember the Great War, I think of, obviously, of those veterans who have died. I think about those veterans, those soldiers who died, who veterans told me about. So I remember some of the names. And then I think about the veterans themselves. And invariably, I go back to sort of my five, I mean, it's horrible to say favourite veterans, but in a sense, they were. And perhaps right at the top of that list was a chap called Ben Clouting, who was 15 years old when he joined the 4th Royal Irish Dragoon Guards, and went to France in August 1914, age 16, and took part in the very first shot of the Great War. He was there at just outside Mons on the 22nd of August 1914 and took part in this altercation with the Germans at a village called Castow. And extraordinarily, that was actually a story that fascinated me. I was obsessed by the first shot, and I used to go read books about it, and I used to study, and, you know, I don't know why, but it just got me, that very, very first contact with the enemy. And when I discovered that the world's last survivor lived 2 miles from my house, I mean, it just felt like, this is fate. This has got to be. And I rang him up, and I, funny enough, I came across him in an old newspaper cutting about the old Contemptibles, you know, the name given to the old regular army, and about their organization closing down in the mid-1970s. And the article started, you know, Ben Clouting, chairman of the Old Contemptibles Association of Reading, says there aren't enough of us left, blah, 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 and we're closing it down. And it said, Ben Clouting, who saw the first shot of the Great War? And I remember just being mesmerized. And there were the five names of the last five veterans. And I went to the register of electors, and four of them were missing, and there was one left, Ben Clouting. And I rang him up, and this incredibly strong, youthful voice picked up the phone. And I said, oh, is that Ben Clouting? Yes. I thought, oh, this is his son. This is definitely his son. And I said, I'm looking for a great war veteran. He said, yep, that was me. He said, yes, you know, right there, right the way through the whole thing. And indeed, he did. He went through 14 to 19, wounded twice, went through virtually every engagement. And so I went to say, I said, can I come and see you? And he said, yep, again, for 2 years until he sadly died of cancer. I went to see him every single Sunday. And then in May 1990, shortly before he died, I had the incredible honour of going to Belgium with him and going back to the location, to the actual site where that first shot took place. And in fact, if you follow me on Twitter, I posted two clips of him talking on the site, on the location of where that first shot took place. And that was extraordinary. And he'd never been back. I mean, that's the first time. Well, he'd been back in 1939 for the opening of a memorial there, but they hadn't actually gone to where the first shot took place. So this was the first time he'd been back since August the 22nd, 1914. So he is a great, for me, again, my son, I mentioned his third name is Harry. His first name is Benjamin after Ben Clouting. And there are other veterans too. Vic Cole, another one, a veteran who lived in Reading. He was just so funny, so erudite about the Great War. He got drunk on many occasions, got busted from Lance Corporal down to Corporal, down to Private again on more than one occasion. In fact, one time he said, I told him I met a veteran of the 1st Battalion of the Royal West Kent Regiment, which Vic had been transferred to. And Vic said, oh, really? He was in my battalion. He said, he was in Italy. I said, yes, he was in Italy in 1917. I said, or 18. And he said, right. Ask him if he remembers this. Ask him if he remembers a soldier being brought out in front of the entire battalion and having his Lance Corporal stripe ripped off him. He said, I'm sure he'll remember that, because that was me. He had no kind. There's nothing that he would hide under a bushel or not tell you about, which again was brilliant, because he would tell you stuff that other veterans would be very guarded. I mean, there was one veteran who was in one of the London regiments, and he told me he was actually went to the occupation of Cologne after the Great War, which is a big interest of mine. And he was telling me about his Great War. He's telling me about the occupation of Cologne, and his wife was there. And that was always the issue. Don't have family members there, because it inhibits them. There are things they want to tell you. They won't tell you because their wife is sitting there. And at one point, his wife said, I'm just going to make a cup of tea. Would you like one? And I said, oh, yes, please. And she went off into the kitchen, and she said, right, VD in Cologne, quickly. And he just told me this story, really in gory detail, about VD in Cologne. And as soon as his wife walked back in, he stopped, you know. And I knew that was the only moment I was going to get that story. Which brings me, actually, I'm rabbiting on here, but there is another story, which absolutely incredible story of another veteran I met called Walter Popple of the 8th King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. He went over the top on the 1st of July, 1916, and was wounded very close to the German trenches. And his story was remarkable. He should have died. In fact, a German spotted him lying there wounded and shot at him and hit his boot, took the heel off his boot off. And Walter said, I knew I was going to die. So I pushed myself up with my one. He'd been shot through the shoulder. So I pushed myself up on with my left, with my right arm, looked straight at the German so he could finish me off. I didn't want to be picked off bit by bit. And the German aimed straight at my head. The bullet hit my helmet, ripped my helmet off, but ricocheted upwards. I then collapsed and realized, of course, the German would have thought he killed me. My helmet was flew off into the air. I lay there for three days and four nights before I crawled back to the British lines. But he was so, so emotional. This story, he said, I've written it down. I can't tell you. So he hadn't told me the story at first. He said, I've written it down. I can't tell you it. I'll get it for you. But he couldn't, from my luck was that he couldn't find it. And he came back. So he eventually told me this story of being there on the 1st of July and what happened to him. It was so, so, so traumatic. And I remember watching him. He was crying as he was telling me. And I was watching these children walking home from school, walking past the living room as he was telling me this, thinking they have no idea what's going on in this room right now. And the story, he finished the story. And again, he said, oh, like a cup of tea. I think he needed a cup of tea. And I said, yes, please. And he said, well, I'll go and get it. Here's the bullet. So this is the bullet that had been taken out of his shoulder, the second intercostal space. I always remember him telling me that. And he gave me the bullet. And I'm sitting there on this old settee and he goes off into the kitchen. Drop the bullet, and the bullet goes down the back of the sofa, and it's one of these old plunging sofas, which meant that every time I put my arm down the back of the sofa, I could touch the bullet, and as soon as I kind of opened the aperture to pick it, the bullet dropped further and further down the back of the sofa, and I could hear him putting biscuits on the teas made, and I was desperate. I had my arm right up to my elbow, it would be back further up to my armpit. As literally as he walked back into the room, I got my hand onto the bullet, pulled it out the back of the sofa with sort of spring grazes all over my arms, you know, where the springs are dug in. He was most bemused. And there I was holding his bullet. And that was just one of those little moments where I thought, my God, he's had this bullet since it was put there by a German, and I'm going to lose it down the back of a sofa. But so there was often, you know, there were often great moments of humour and lovely moments of contact with these veterans, you know, whether the situations like that or others, you know, I could rabbit on for hours, as you could tell. But those three veterans are three of my favourite ones, I have to say.
As you're telling those stories, Richard, it just makes me just realise what a privilege it is. I mean, I've had the privilege as well of speaking to veterans. And I remember at one time I was in Vietnam with a bunch of Australian Vietnam veterans. And we were sitting around at the end of the day having a beer. And it was just them and me. It was about six veterans and me. And they started telling each other the stories that I knew they hadn't even shared with their family. And I just said to myself, Matt, don't speak. You know, just soak this in. And it's just such a rare privilege that I've always found that veterans, if they think you understand, that's enough for them to open up to you. You don't have to have been there. You don't have to have served beside them. But if they comprehend that you understand the significance of what they went through and why it's important, that they open up to you. Did you find that in your experience of interviewing veterans?
Yes, absolutely. Sensitivity was key. If you went blundering in with, so did you lose your best mate? You know, they were going to absolutely close up. They weren't going to tell you anything. I remember one veteran, again, an old contemptible, Basil Farrer, saying to me, he'd been interviewed for television he was from Nottingham, so probably Midlands TV or something. And he said, this lady was so insensitive because she basically opened up with, tell me your worst Great War story. You know, the one that makes you kind of wake up sweating at night, because she wanted that easy story for her program. So if I can just go in, get that brilliant story, I don't need to bother about anything else. And he basically told her nothing. And he was so angry about it. He was so angry at the way that she'd just kind of thrown herself into this and just said, oh, okay, you know, tell me what you need to tell me just for my peace. So, of course, he told her nothing, absolutely nothing. And that was it. If you had to make them, you didn't have to make, as you say, you didn't have to be an expert. You didn't have to make them feel that you knew an awful lot about the subject. And my God, some of the early interviews I did, I knew nothing. What they had to feel was that you cared. The fact that you wanted to hear their stories, but you would let them lead the way. You would let them tell the stories as they wanted to tell them. And you weren't just going to kind of batter them with, you know, tell me your worst nightmare. Tell me the name of your best friend who was killed. And, you know, those sort of utterly insensitive questions, which I suspect some people on occasions ask, and which I desperately tried to avoid. There were times, you know, there were times when I probably asked questions that maybe I should have left for another time, or weren't at the right, weren't apposite at that particular moment. But I always felt that they understood that I really wanted to know, and it meant such a lot to me as it did to them. And so that's, I suspect, one of the reasons why they were willing to talk to me, and why I had, you know, as I say, only one real blank refusal.
Were there veterans that you were really looking forward to speaking to that you missed out on speaking to over the years?
Absolutely. I mean, there was one we were going to film who I'd interviewed on two or three occasions, and I said, we must film this guy. He's absolutely extraordinary. Again, Delville Wood on the Somme was a big story for him. And we were literally, he said, I'm going to do this interview, and I'm never then going to talk about the Great War again. This is it. This is my final interview. And he'd never been caught on camera before. And we were driving up to Hexham outside Newcastle in the north of England. And we got a call saying he died in the night. And so that was one where, although I'd met him, although I'd interviewed, I've got tape recordings with him, we needed him on camera because his story was so, so good. There were other times when I remember a chap called Billingham, I think his surname was, who wrote to me. I'd sent out some feelers to various veterans, and he wrote back and said, I'm delighted to speak to you. Come and see me anytime. I was at Beaumont Hamel in November 1916. I can tell you all about that. And I just left it. And not for very long, you know, two or three weeks, maybe a month. And then I rang him up. And I said, well, I must go and see him this weekend. I rang him up, and the phone rang and rang and rang. And I thought, oh, he's obviously gone out, or he's asleep. And I kept ringing, and then 2 weeks later, the line went dead, and I realised that he died. And that was one if I'd gone to see him straight away, he was 103, I think, at the time, he would have been a great interview. He was very happy to talk. I've still got the letter, but I never met him. And there are veterans like that that I look back and think, oh, why didn't I just go? Why did I leave it two weekends or three weekends? I could have gone. And so those are my biggest regrets. But equally, there were big regrets where questions that I didn't ask that now on reflection, I think would have elicited all sorts of new stories. But also, you know, I went to the Somme. In fact, 2019 was the first year I haven't been to the Somme since 1985. I've been every single year. And so when I interviewed Somme veterans, you know, I had a sort of sense of where they were and what the locations. But that wasn't true of the Somme, of Gallipoli. And I interviewed probably interviewed over 20, 25 Gallipoli veterans over the years, all before I went with Peter Hart to Gallipoli. And I wrote a book with a great friend of mine, Stephen Chambers, on Gallipoli. With some amazing, using original soldiers' photographs. And I said, before I write this book, I have to go to Gallipoli. I have to go to these locations. So I went twice with Peter Hart, and wonderful, wonderful tours. But I realised then how much I missed when I spoke to the Gallipoli veterans, having not been at that time to Gallipoli, how much I missed their story, because I didn't really appreciate the terrain and the locations that they were talking about. And that, again, is a big regret. I should have gone a lot earlier.
You mentioned photos, Richard, and I know that's another passion of yours, not just having spoken to these veterans, but also collecting their photographs that they took while they were over there. Just tell us a little bit about that and the importance of the photographic record to you.
Yeah, I mean, the soldiers' camera, the ubiquitous camera on the Western Front was called the Best Pocket Kodak. And this was this kind of cheap and easy camera to take if you were going to go to the Western Front and take a camera with you. The British authorities, the army were very sceptical about the use of these cameras and banned them just actually a couple of days before Christmas 1914. They were aware of the fact that officers were loading, aiming and shooting their cameras as opposed to their revolvers, and also saw privately taken photographs appearing in the British press. And of course, they wanted control of that. So cameras were banned. And so you get, for the number of men who were on the Western Front, very, very few cameras. But given there were, you know, at any one time by 1916, 2 million men who were over there, you're going to have some who ignored the laws and kept cameras with them. And it's their story, it's the story of the Great War told through their cameras, which I find absolutely fascinating. They're different from those images taken by the official photographer, not least because the official photographer didn't arrive on the Western Front until January 1916. So any pictures you see of the Western Front pre that are almost invariably taken by soldiers on their own cameras. And it's the stories that they take, the fact that they're so relaxed with one another. And with the official photographer, you can see them on occasions they tense up, you know, it's a posed picture. But also, you know, when they put these out pictures in their albums, these really personal images, they would often say, this is Bill, this is Bob, this is Phil, this is, you know, this person died on the Somme on this particular date. And so you get a kind of window on their world. And there's one incredible, I wrote a book on the Somme using these private photographs. And there's there's a picture I took from an album of a man who was in the Royal Garrison Artillery. And there's a wonderful, wonderful pictures of him in no man's land. Just behind the British front line. And he's standing there with his brother. Now, the extraordinary thing about that is his brother had emigrated to Australia before the Great War, and they just happened to meet in the middle of the Somme battlefield. His brother had joined the Australian forces, was walking across, and he just went, "My God, it's you." And so because he had his camera with him, he got someone to take a photograph of them both together in the middle of the Somme. Wonderful, wonderful photograph. And they, after a hug and a chat, they parted company. They never met again. Both survived the Great War, but his brother went back to Australia. He had no financial means to go and see his brother, and obviously perhaps the other way around too. So he never met again. The last time they met was in the middle of the Somme. So there are photographs that really mean so much. So if they were taken by the official photographer, we'd just go, it's two men together. It's the backstory that means such a lot. And he's got another picture in his album. And it's of no great consequence, this particular image. It's of a gun battery in the snow in the winter of 1617. It's not actually well taken. It's obviously freezing cold, so his hands have been, you know, a bit sort of sticky, and so he's shaking the camera slightly. But the inscription says, 6 hours after this photograph was taken, this battery took a direct hit and these men died. Again, suddenly a picture that you would pass over, would think nothing of, suddenly becomes incredibly interesting, incredibly historically significant, and so, so moving. And it's these images that I just am so passionate about, because it's like having a window on these men's war. It's the pictures they took were the pictures that mattered to them. And sometimes, I mean, I've got a couple of albums, I've got more than that, where one image is missing and you can see the notation underneath and you realise that they've put this album together and before they've died, they felt that picture is too personal to pass on. And there's one album where it says, stretcher bearer coming down with dying man, passing me with a dying man. And he probably felt guilty about the fact he'd taken his camera out and photographed this man on a stretcher just before he died. Whether he knew him or not, I don't know. But he'd obviously put that in the album and then decided at whatever time to take that picture out and destroy it. And so you get these little gaps occasionally in the albums, which you realise these pictures meant so much to these veterans, they weren't going to pass them on for future generations. I understand why. But as I say, it's this window on this soldier's world that fascinates me. So I pursue these albums everywhere I can get them. In fact, I've just bought one. It's by an Australian infantry officer, I think. Unfortunately, he names the places, he names the locations, but he doesn't name his battalion or he doesn't say who he is. So it's a great album. Lots of pictures around Gueudicourt on the Somme. Pictures up at Ypres. So I may be able to pin down the battalion if I do some research just by the locations, but some lovely, lovely pictures of Australians in their slouch hats and standing in front of Albert Basilica, of course, that famous symbol of the Somme. So I, as you say, I'm rabbiting on again. I absolutely adore the soldier's private image.
That's why we have you on here, Richard. It's not rabbiting on at all, I'm sure. I'm sure I speak for everyone listening when I say that it's just a wonderful insight into, something that we've lost now. And I'm very grateful for the work you've done preserving these memories, because if people like you and Peter Hart and other diligent souls, Paul Reed is another one who spoke to lots of veterans, if you hadn't taken their stories down, they'd probably be lost to us forever. So just thank you for taking the time. If people want to find more about what you're doing, what's the latest project you're working on?
Well, I unfortunately, because of lockdown, my latest book is Missing, The Need for Closure After the Great War, which is a story, a post-war story of a mother's search for her missing son. He was a RFC pilot who shot down, a pilot who was shot down in May 1918. And it's some wonderful, wonderful letters from him, plus her search for his body, because his body was missing for 5 years, and she undertook her own personal search to discover him. So that's my latest book. That's the one that I've been, unfortunately, not been able to promote as much as I would like to because of lockdown. So I'm doing that, but I'm also updating Boy Soldiers of the Great War, which was, again, a passion of mine, the story of the underage lads who went to the Western Front. Updated with what I call my top 50 list of youngest boys on the Western Front and at Gallipoli. So I've just found, I think I found my 53rd or 54th lad aged under 15 on the Western Front or Gallipoli. So these are boys who have to be aged 13 or 14, not in service, but actually in a theatre of war. And the youngest, I've got three lads who are aged 13 on the Western Front. I've got another, 50 who are age 14, either on the Somme or at Gallipoli, a couple in Mesopotamia as well. So that's going to be that's what I'm doing at the moment, just updating that particular book, which has been an ongoing passion of mine for 20 years now. And just the story of I always said 250,000 underage lads enlisted in the Great War. Well, I can tell you now it's more than that, absolutely more than that. All the stats I'm doing now shows that it's a higher figure. Exactly where I'll land, I'm not sure, but it's a most fascinating story.
It's just absolutely brilliant work you're doing, Richard. Thank you very much for your contribution to the historic record, and thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us about it. If you're listening to this and you want to keep up with what Richard Van Emden is doing, certainly follow him on Twitter and other social media channels, because it's just great work that you're doing. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us about it.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Matt. Anytime.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.